welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I, Larry Mueller here. Jeff Epping is back with us. Jeff is Director of Horticulture at Obrecht Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm going to talk with him about keeping your garden healthy in dry conditions like the one we're in right now in a good share of the state. And interested in what you have to say. What do you do to conserve water in your garden? Or do you have plants that do well in drought conditions? Other gardening questions that you might have, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And Jeff Epping, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's always great to be here. It's been a while, especially since I've been in the studio, so this is quite a treat.
Yeah, it's great to have you back in person. And I understand that Obrecht Botanical Gardens has won a very nice award. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you bet. So the American Horticultural Society awarded us with what they call their Garden Stewardship Award. And right from their page or website, it says, this award is given to a public garden that it embraces and exemplifies sustainable horticultural practices and design, maintenance, and programs. So, you know, it's a really nice award in recognizing us for what we've been trying to do for many, many years, and that is garden in a more ecologically friendly manner and reduce the amount of water, which we'll talk a little bit about today, as well as, you know, chemicals and all the energy inputs that go into our gardens. And so we're trying to set an example for others to garden in a way that's better for the planet. So it was, really nice to have that
award. Yeah,
that is
a nice award.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned water, and here we are, what is it, the last 2 years, there have been low precipitation in the garden. And what can 2 years? 2 years can do a lot.
And we're seeing plants that are suffering from last year alone coming into the season. A lot of the evergreens, things like hemlocks and arborvitae, and I've seen that all around Madison, where not just new plantings, but plantings that have been in for, you know, 10 or more years are dead. Especially arborvitae. You know, arborvitae is a plant that likes moisture, is native to habitats with lots of moisture. And when we put it in our normal garden soils with our normal rainfall, it does quite well, actually, a good native plant. But in times of drought, and especially extended drought, and going into a winter when the plants can still lose moisture but can't take any up, they really take a hit. And we've been seeing a lot of that. So, you know, giving them a drink of water at certain times of the year is critical, especially in the fall. And this spring, we were doing some of that to catch up on the moisture that they needed.
Yeah.
We just need rain. But in the meanwhile, we'll do what we can to keep everything as healthy as possible.
I think there's some obvious signs, you know, of lack of water. But are there just, I mean, as you just look at your plants, how do you know if they're getting into trouble?
Well, we saw a lot of sort of tip dieback, especially hemlock. We just actually even noticing it now where the plants are leafing out with new growth, because conifers do that a little bit later in the season. And some of the new growth is just flagging, as we call it, or wilting, bending over because there's no moisture there. And then they turn brown. Just kind of looking at your plants, you know, in the heat of the day, especially lately, it's been, again, so darn hot on top of the dry. So it's not unusual for a plant, even if it has a fair amount of moisture available, to wilt during those super hot parts of the day and when it's windy like it has been. But in the evening and in the morning is when the plants, you know, will either sort of perk back up or not. And so look at your garden at those times to see what those plants are looking like. And if they're wilting at that time, then it's a good sign that they need, you know,
need to get some
extra water. But, you know, mulch is a good way to conserve moisture once you do get it in the ground. Plant tightly so your plants are all grouped together. That not only helps the plants because they like to grow in sort of a plant community, it helps the gardener because we're not giving a bunch of open space in between the plants and for weeds to grow. And so now we're weeding more than we should and all those sorts of things. So, you know, we're just trying to trying to keep the plants healthy at this point. You know, during a drought, we're not trying to water our garden like crazy to make it look like a normal, yeah, quote unquote year.
Yeah.
Because then we're using more water than we need to. And first and foremost, when we design our gardens or tweak our gardens over time, because, you know, we may put in some plants that are not all that drought tolerant, but plucking some of those out and putting in plants that are. And many of our native plants really are the most drought tolerant, especially if you have sunny locations, our prairie species, you know, deeply rooted, very well adapted to those conditions. And so we're trying to do more of that at Olbrich and doing that a lot in my home garden as well. And the benefits of native plants go beyond being drought tolerant, of course. They're good, yeah, for all the pollinators and insects, which then feed our small mammals, feed our birds, all those things. So the native plants are important in many ways in our gardens.
Absolutely. Jeff Epping, our guest today, talking with him about gardening, and we're looking at dry conditions here to begin with just a bit, but you can join in with your questions. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Again, 1-800-642-1234. You know, I think new plants and new trees, when it comes to water, I think we make some mistakes. I know we've talked in the past, even on a new tree, or especially if it's an evergreen type tree, not getting watering right up until the ground freezes practically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
If you want to keep it.
Yeah. So again, getting those plants fully hydrated before they go into the winter months when the soil freezes.
Yeah.
And then there's no moisture available. But because they're evergreen, they can continue to lose moisture through the winter, you know, especially on, again, sunny or windy days. And again, we make sure that all of our plants are well mulched in the fall, because yeah, that keeps the soil from freezing until, you know, the temperature really gets low. And so, again, maximizing the amount of moisture those plants can take up until the ground does freeze.
What do you think of it for the home gardener? Planting in the fall, planting in the spring is, I mean, I suppose most of us do it in the spring, but.
I think you can, you know, you can do both. I know as a home gardener, I'm a little more excited about planting in spring.
Yeah.
By fall, after the vagaries of tending to my garden all summer, I sometimes just be like, I'm done. And even bulb planting, some years I do a lot, and other years it's like, I'm just done. It was a hard summer. And but either is good. But getting them in those two times is a lot easier than doing it like now in the middle of summer.
Yeah.
Because if you can get them planted late in the fall, they'll have, or early spring, they'll have some time to get some roots out into that soil and adjust to their location until the warmer weather hits.
Yeah.
And which will help with, again, with getting them established and the drought tolerance and all those things.
And if you've got a prairie, kind of little prairie planting area, depending on when you plant fall or spring makes a difference in kind of who might survive or who might flower, you know, depending on the plants.
Right. And with perennials in the fall, you just have to make sure you get them in early enough. So I think, you know, September we're still okay with. You can get away with it later, but what might happen with perennial plantings if they go in late in the season is we get what we call frost heaving, where it literally the frost pushes the plants up out of the ground, especially if they're a smaller plant. And, you know, in those January thaws or whatever, you got to get out there and look and push them back down into the ground and that sort of thing. And a lot, you know, again, a lot of our plants are pretty tough. If you give them a fighting chance, they'll be okay. But that would be the one caveat is the later perennial plantings, you're going to have to maybe do a little extra to keep them happy and going.
What do you think about, let's say, maybe somebody's got an open palette out there where they're just getting started with their garden or designing their garden. What about designing gardens that do well in dry conditions? I mean, you've done a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the design phase is, I think, the most important phase and one that I think people often don't spend enough time with. They go to the garden center in spring, they see something in flower, and they buy it. And then they go home and they try to find a spot for it. They don't really know what that plant necessarily likes, what its requirements are for sun, shade, drought, whatever. And so we have the benefit of a nice long winter here in Wisconsin. That's the best time to put together a really nice design for yourself. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, hiring somebody who does know that pays off big time in the long haul, because you will then invest all of your money in plants that are well adapted to your conditions, which will thrive in those conditions. And, you know, it's just so much easier to be a gardener when your plants are in the proper place. And so that design end of it is important, like I say. And if you like to do things yourself, which I do, not only in gardening, but other things, you know, do some research. Come to Olbrich, take some classes, the Arboretum. You know, there's so much available now online, great classes to learn more and more about all these different plants that we can use. And like I say, it's sometimes you want to just jump in and do something, but it's better to do a little planning and live with your garden. Even like when I bought my new house 20 years ago, I just lived with my garden for a year to see what, you know, where the dry spots, where the spots with lots of moisture, where the sun was, where the shade was, and figuring that all out before I put together a design.
I'm thinking about my my own property now, or my own home, because the my daughter is now in college, and so that back lawn where she kicked the soccer ball around, you know, that is lawn, because it had to be lawn for the kids, and the neighbor kids came over, and a lot of that. Now I'm trying to decide what I want to do with that. I've had all the prettier stuff in the front, which is fine, but I wouldn't like to maybe do something different in the back.
Well, and I lawns are useful. Lawns are a good thing when we use them.
Yeah.
How many acres of grass do we mow in this country that are only set foot on by the people who are tending to them? We are blessed in Madison with parks everywhere. And I am lucky to have a small pocket park just off my backyard. So I don't have any lawn. I have a gravel garden in the front of my home where it used to be lawn when I first moved in. I converted that to first a minimal mow meadow, our fescue meadow, where I just had to mow it a few times a year. So I felt pretty good about that, but it didn't do a lot for pollinators. So I decided to do a little more and go with a gravel gardening route, which I've done a lot with over the years. And it's been a lot of fun. And then the back is more shady. And so I just put a path, stepping stone path through a sedge lawn with other mixed perennials in that. And it's both of those gardens are just teeming with insects and birds and wildlife. So, you know, they're doing a good thing for others, not just me. And that's not me to look at and enjoy. And so I feel good about that. And I think all of us probably have some opportunities to convert some of that lawn over to something more useful to the creatures that need those spaces. You know, our wild areas are getting smaller and smaller all the time, and development, you know, just look across Madison or anywhere USA, all the suburbs are booming. The wildlands get all the trees get cut down to put in these housing developments, and then what goes back? Not the native trees that they cut down, lawn. lawn and more lawn and more lawn, and with a few pittance of trees around here and there. And so it really, there is a movement out there to really start looking at how we garden and to reduce that amount of lawn, because not only does it not offer much of wildlife value, it also is super consumptive of energy and water, from gasoline to fertilizers to pesticides and chemicals to water. 40% of our water goes on lawns. It's an amazing, I mean, across the United States, that's where 40% of our fresh water goes, on a lawn that, again, we just look at. We play on from time to time, but there's places for that, of course, like you mentioned. So anyway, I think you're doing a great service by looking at that lawn, Larry, and trying to do something different with it.
Jeff Epping, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. We can go down that conversation with him about lawns for sure, but we can also talk about plants. And maybe you have some ideas or questions about your own flowers or your own garden plants. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Dinner's our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer, of course. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Great to have him back. Certainly questions or comments, join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, I'm looking, I've got your events calendar in front of me, and I'm taking a look at the great events that are set for July, and certainly, and there's a garden tour.
Yeah, every year Olbrich sponsors a home garden tour, and we move it to a different part of the city or some of the surrounding suburbs. And this year it's in Oregon, Wisconsin, which is about a 20-minute drive outside of Madison. And there's about six or seven gardens on that tour. And these are all people who love to garden. And it's a great way to see, you know, what other people are doing and how they're doing it, and ask questions. We have docents available at every site to answer questions. Plants are labeled. So it's just a lot of fun. It's on the Friday and Saturday, the 8th and 9th. And so you just buy your ticket out there and, you know, go from garden to garden and have a good time.
And they're all relatively close once you get there.
Yeah, right. They're all, some are within walking distance, then maybe a short drive to the next group. And yeah, it's really a nice way to see what everybody's up to and enjoy all the fruits of their hard work and labor.
And they probably did a little extra work, I'm guessing.
Oh, yes. I was on it last year, so I had to put my money where my mouth was last year. And, I put in the work for sure, but it was worth it.
But well worth it for everybody who gets to see them. They're always, those tours are always fun. Jan in Viroqua has something for us. Let's go there. Jan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, happy holiday weekend to you guys.
To you as well.
Thank you. Jeff, I would love to hear you talk at some length about plant spacing, because I've always felt guilty that I was crowding my plants and trying to move them apart in the perennial garden. And I'm always, when I read a seed packet and I'm planting annuals to grow from seed, I don't know whether to crowd them more or than the packet does, or whether they need that much space to grow, or whether I should plant a lot and then.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a great question. And I think that's something that designers are doing very differently than they used to. You know, you like you say, you look at a plant label and they have all these rigid measurements, how tall it's going to get, how wide it's going to get, and you put them on those spacings. But I'll tell you what, you look at nature, you look at a prairie, you look in a woodland at the trees, you look at nature, they don't read those packets or follow them in any way, shape, or form. If there's open ground, they grow in it. and they fill all that available space. And that's why, that's how we should be gardening, because it makes it much easier to garden that way. Some may argue that, well, you know, if I have phlox and I have it too crowded in, I might get some powdery mildew. It needs good air drainage. Well, whatever. If it gets powdery mildew, there's a plant next to you. Won't see it. It'll flower. It'll be beautiful. It'll be much easier to maintain. So we, if you come out to Olbrich and look at what we're doing out there, and we have a new planting around our new learning center, the Frauchi Family Learning Center, all new perennial plantings. And you can see how closely we're spacing them. And it's a nice year to do it because we just finished planting last fall. And you can see the spacing. And you can see the space even between them at this young age. But I'll tell you what, next season you won't see that space after everything starts getting growing. And we have a number of flowering meadows, the Moonlight Meadow and the Autumn Meadow, that has that same sort of style of planting. And it's more naturalistic. It's sort of plant community-based, as people are calling it in the industry. And putting those plants close together, shading the soil. If you shade the soil with plants, weed seeds won't have a chance to germinate and get going. And we're actually layering plants now, where we'll use taller plants that require full sun to do their thing under those plants, especially upright plants. Underneath those, we're planting sedges that like to be in shade. Now, in spring, when the sedges really come up and grow quickly and fill the ground, they can take the full sun. They're happy, just like they would in a woodland, right? In the spring, mm-hmm. there's no leaves on the trees, and the yeah. sedges thrive in that situation. So they quickly cover the ground in spring. Then the perennials start growing up through them and higher and provide the shade that the sedges need when we have the heat and high, you know, intensity sunshine that we do in the summer. So then they're happy underneath those big guys, choking out the weeds, doing their thing, and we get to enjoy the taller forbs and grasses that come up above them. So we are definitely crowding the plants in, and we're fine. It's paying dividends for us. So not only do we get more diversity and more beauty with all the different types of plants that we're put in that space, but it's lowering the amount of maintenance that we have to put into the garden as well.
Yeah, that's just some great thoughts. Jan, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Kay in Stoughton next. Hi, Kay.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about my alliums. I have a large perennial garden, and the alliums always bloom and everything. In fact, have spread into our grassy field area next to it from me throwing the seeds in there. But they do, the plants get kind of yellow, like midway through their blooming. Does that mean they're lacking something in the soil?
Well, there's a lot of different allium species. I'm not exactly sure which one. Is it more like a chives, do you suppose? Is it a very small early blooming?
No, I have chives also. Okay. But no, this is the larger alliums that I bought, you know, the starter bulbs or whatever you call them for years
okay.
ago.
But this is a perennial one, not like a bulb like Globemaster or something that comes up and blooms and then stops blooming, you know, early spring.
No.
Okay.
It stops blooming. But
it has nice foliage typically. Okay. Yeah. So there's a pretty good number of cultivars out there. The most popular one is Summer Beauty Allium, which has beautiful foliage about 12 inches tall. And then the flowers come up above that to about 18 inches. And they don't reseed, fortunately, because some of the alliums are a little too prolific in seeding. Chives is one of those. But the clumps do get bigger over time. And so maybe you would like to divide those up. They're super tough and easy to do that. Typically in early spring before they're just coming out of the ground would be the easiest time. But you could even do that now if you wanted to. It'll take a little more effort with some watering and such. But probably spring or fall would be best. But, you know, with that said, we have some clumps of allium that have been in the ground for 10 years and we have done really nothing to them. And they're doing beautifully. So I'm not sure if it's every one of the plants you're talking about, or there's just some of them that are affected that way, or it's in it. And without knowing exactly which allium it is, it's kind of hard to know, but
Do they need, like, I don't really fertilize them. Do they need a high amount of fertilizer?
No, not typically. Most perennials don't really need much fertilizer at all. In fact, we don't fertilize our perennials because then they grow too fast with too much nitrogen. They flop over. Open up in the center, you know, like with some of the grasses. And so then you have to divide them to make them look good again. So a great example of not needing fertilizer, even any amount of additional organic matter, is what we're doing in our gravel gardens, where we have put the plant drought-tolerant perennials. Again, a lot of them are native U.S. native prairie plants in 4 to 5 inches of deep gravel. And so they don't get additional organic matter from the foliage at the end of the year because we clean that up and take it away because we don't want organic matter to bring to build up in that soil. So they do get organic matter that is produced by the roots because they produce new roots. Roots die, so they do benefit from that. But however, so we don't fertilize those at all. We haven't fertilized since, well, our first one went in 2009 and all those years, and those plants are doing great. They don't, I think, actually in gardening, we often over-fertilize, over-water, and maybe even sometimes over-mulch, where we're adding too much organic matter to the soil. So I'm doubtful that you would need to add any amount of fertilizer.
Thank you, Kay. Appreciate it. You know, maybe talk a bit more about that gravel. We've talked about it, I don't know, a year or two ago.
Right.
I can't even remember when we did, but I'm sure there are people who say, what's this about a gravel?
Right. No, we did one show with you, and that was kind of the focus. And since that time, it's kind of cool. Margaret Roach, who's the garden writer for the New York Times, did a story about about the gravel gardening movement that kind of started here in the Midwest. So that was awfully fun. And Margaret's a great garden writer. But basically what we're doing is we're, again, using very drought-tolerant perennials, putting them in a system of sorts. So we remove all the vegetation that's on the site. We border that area, if we need to, with sort of like an edger of some sort.
Yeah.
So you can use boulders, you can use pavers, you can use the curb on the street, which I did. It's part of mine. And why you do that is because we're putting down 4 to 5 inches of gravel, and we want that gravel to be that depth right to the very edge of whatever amount of space we're making this garden in. Why? Because the gravel creates a weed barriers for weed seeds to be able to germinate and grow, you know, get established in that gravel. That's a pretty tough thing for them to do. And we're finding that it's really a super low maintenance garden because no weeds invade. Now, in the beginning, right after planting, we may have a few weeds that are actually in the crowns of the plants that we just planted. We got those as bonus gifts from our nurseries or whatever. That's just inevitable. So it might weed a little bit then. But in future years, you don't have an issue with that. The main chore is spring cleanup. So we have to take off all of that organic matter that's above and then, you know, get rid of that. And we use, even after we do a cleanup, this is in early spring in March, before the bulbs are even coming up, because bulbs thrive in those gardens too. We cut it back, we leave it sit a few days, make sure everything's dried up, and then we use a little battery-powered blower, the rake, get that out of the gravel. And we just use that organic matter in our surrounding beds as a mulch. So at Olbrich, we're not taking away our plants anymore and putting them in a big old pile. And we're reusing all that organic matter that the plants produce. Not only is it more better use of energy, what do most people have been taught to do is throw everything out on the curb, let the city take it away. Now we bring haul mulch back in and mulch with organic matter, which we just got rid of, especially the leaves in the fall. So we are changing our ways, and a lot of people who are, you know, have learned as we have to do this are in that same movement. So at home, I don't haul anything away. I'm grabbing those leaves off the curb down the street where people have big, beautiful oaks that they you know, rake underneath and get rid of. I go up my pickup truck, pick that up. This year, I just put the whole leaves as they were in my garden rather than shred them. I used to put them on the lawn in the park because I don't have a lawn, mow them, and then put them back on. But what the research is finding from our entomologists is that all of these overwintering insects, especially many of our native moths, are in those leaves. And we're killing them by throwing it all away and putting it in a big compost pile somewhere at the edge of the city, or even in our own gardens, as I used to do, mowing them. I don't do that now. And what's so cool, Larry, is that every time I've planted a perennial this season, and I still have a few to put in the ground because that's just the way I am. I never get it done in the spring. When I'm planting, a moth comes flying out of those leaves all in and around my plants. I swear, every time I plant something. So I'm allowing those guys to grow and thrive. And again, they are such an important food source for, bats and other birds and such. So, again, doing things in a little bit more environmental way. And it's easier. I am leaving the stuff on site. I am not spending money for somebody to haul, wood mulch or whatever mulch I use back into my garden. So it's a win-win for everybody. So, I always say people want to know, they want to do the right thing. They just don't always know what that is. And I know I had lawn when I first started gardening. I did things the traditional way because that's how I was taught, and either by my parents or in horticulture classes or whatever. So it's always learning, always learning. My staff at Olbrich I'll give them all the credit for always looking for new ideas, researching things, and putting those to practice in the garden. And sharing that information. So it's all good.
It is indeed. Let's take a call from Megan and Nina. Megan, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question about, we had some buckthorn in the back of our yard that we cut down, and we also have a lot of water back there. I'm trying to do a bit of a rain garden with native plants. I was wondering if you had any suggestions to keep the buckthorn gone, and that will other plants that will take up the water and be great for pollinators.
Mm-hmm. So do you, have you eliminated the buckthorn at this point? Or are they still sort of resprouting and all that good stuff?
Yeah. We've cut it off, but the suckers are coming back up.
Right. I know, a lot of restorationists will dab those cut ends with some type of herbicide, which, we don't like to do. The other way is, Larry, is anybody still doing I know you have so many people on your program who deal with this sort of thing. What is the latest and greatest, as far as you know, is trying to get rid of that?
Well, that's what people are still doing.
Using the herbicide.
They're using herbicide and, as carefully as they can and on, freshly cut, stump type thing, situations.
Right.
And just putting it on just where it, some people are actually using a little cone type situation where they actually put the cone over so that does not spread beyond.
Right. So just hitting that cut, that cut stump. Again, nobody is environmentally, as we try to garden every once in a while, you have to kind of go back to something like that to start anew, we occasionally use Roundup at the garden when we convert an area, say, from turf to a meadow. And I do some work for others too. And, we at one last time that we're using that chemical, which on a lawn has been chemicalized for how many years, we get rid of that. We start anew. Now we're creating this really awesome new garden. And so in your situation, getting rid of those buckthorns really would be important, because if you don't, it's going to be so much harder to get that garden established and thrive. So anyway, getting rid of the buckthorn. And then I know the DNR for sure has some great lists of rain garden plants on their website. I've looked at them before. The Arboretum probably does as well. I gave Larry and Joe a list today of native plants that we are using and promoting anywhere from perennials to trees to shrubs to vines, sedges, all those. And I think they're going to try to make that available, Larry.
Yeah, we are indeed. It's a great list. It's probably about 9 pages of materials on all these various forbs and vines and grasses and sedges and trees and shrubs. It's just a wonderful list of the natives. And we're posting that. If you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and that's go to today's date, and we'll have a link. We'll have it. You can click on it and probably copy it off if you want to, or just go back to it.
Sure.
It's got a lot of sources. And so, Megan, I think that'd be a good thing for you to do as well. The rain garden, the information on the DNR website is really good.
It is, yes.
And on rain gardens.
Yeah. And so just hitting those up, and then your next challenge then will be to find those native plants, because you're not going to go to a big box store and find them. You're going to buy them from like Prairie Nursery. or a number of different native plant nurseries that specialize in that sort of thing. But they're out there. And if you do a little Google searching, you'll find those sources and, get off to a really good start.
Thank you very much for calling. Jay and Two Rivers, your turn now. Jay, hi. Thanks for calling.
Happy Independence Weekend, gentlemen.
To you as well.
Thank you.
Hey, many decades ago, when I had been using my Scott's real-type Pushmore, I believe the highest that I could set it was only 2 or 2.5 inches. But for the last 25 years, I've been using a mulching mower, so I don't have to bag the clippings. And I've been mowing at, say, 3.5 to 4 inches with good results. It does help to keep the weeds down. But it seems counterintuitive that less water is required. Could you explain the science behind it? It seems to work, but I'm just wondering why the longer blades of grass don't require more water.
Yeah, that's a great question. That is because there's been a lot of research done on this, mainly by the athletic sports industry, golf courses, that sort of thing. And the more leaf blade there is left on a grass, the deeper the root system will grow. So there's a direct relationship. So you mowing at 4 inches, 3.5, 4 inches is awesome. If you're going to have a lawn, that's definitely what you should be doing. And then it allows the plant to get more deeply rooted, have more moisture available to it. So it's then hence more drought tolerant. Now the next step forth is to, if you're going to have lawn, I would strongly suggest you switch to more drought tolerant grasses. And those typically are the fescues. So the fine fescues and tall fescue, rather than Kentucky bluegrass. Kentucky bluegrass is our most water-consumptive turf grass that we could grow. And, when things were a little cooler and a little more moist in years past, we could get away with that. And maybe they'd go into dormancy, once or twice a season, and they'd pop right back. But now it seems things are getting hotter and droughts longer. And now you have to water them to keep them alive through those periods, and that's not good. So those fescues kind of laugh at that kind of drought. they once they get them established and you mow them high like you're doing, they do fine.
Jay, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Jeff Epping, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. We're talking gardening with him today. We've zeroed in a bit on gardening in dry conditions, which we've had over a good part of the state. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Lois in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have several things. One, in the springtime, I have all these tall stems that I have to pull out of my garden from different flowers and plants and things. I mean, I don't know what to do with them because you can't put them back on the garden. They don't break down. I can't put them in my compost because it's a big heap. Do you have any suggestions?
Wow. That's. I'm glad you brought that up because research is showing that many of our native bees actually need those stems to produce in. So they lay their eggs in hollow stems of many of our perennials, even some of our woody plants if they have a hollow pith to them. We are cutting those at about 8 inches or so we can leave them stand. The new growth grows right through them. And the native bees, which there's over 400 species of, I don't know how many of those use hollow stems to produce their young in, but a good number of them. And then the stems that we cut, we either use in some of our native bee houses that we have made, or we just pile them behind shrubs or something in the garden, and nobody sees them. And then they're useful at actually providing homes for the native bees and other insects as well. And a lot of times, insects lay their eggs in the fall on all of the dormant parts of these plants. And if we just take all that material and toss it out, we're tossing out all those good insects as well. So if they're really long, go ahead and cut them up into 6-inch or 8-inch sections to make them more manageable. But even in my home garden now, I am doing that sort of thing. If I have twigs falling from my trees or whatever, I just break them up with my hands and I throw them back down on the ground. And well, you think about what do we do, Larry? We buy truckloads of wood mulch to mulch our gardens. But if a twig falls, we throw it away. It's wood. It's the same thing. And a lot of times, again, if it's twigs from native plants, into certain types of insects use those as habitat to live in our gardens. So it's and oftentimes you do that and you don't even see it because the plants all around it are just grow over it anyway. And I be keeping that organic mulch that I'm producing on my own garden in my garden, not hauling it off and spending fuel to get it to haul it somewhere else, right? So
there you go, Lois.
How's that?
Thank you very much for calling. Don in Holman, we'll go to you. Don, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
You were talking about that gravel gardening area, and then you got off on a tangent and you didn't really finish the discussion. I have a question. Is that gravel then like a mulch and you just plant in it and it keeps weeds from growing and the stuff just keeps coming up back up through the gravel? Or because I just happen to have about a half a yard of crushed limestone that I was using in a trench actually to feed a whole drainage area into a rain garden that I'm developing. I've got a little bit of that crushed limestone left, and maybe that's what I can use it for if I figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if we have enough time today to go into all the fine details, but I actually wrote an article for Fine Gardening Magazine a few years back on gravel gardening, and it's probably still available online if you were to look it up. So Fine Gardening, just type in that, and Gravel Gardening Jeff Epping. If you can't find it, email me at Olbrich, and my email address is jepping, so J-E-P-P-I-N-G, @cityofmadison.com, and I will send you a link to that. And I've written a number of articles over the years, too. But it has all the details. I do lectures all over the country talking about it. And it's so there's a lot of nuances. Crushed gravel will not work, though, I'll tell you that. It needs to be a washed gravel. We use about a 1/4-inch size, like pea gravel size. Pea gravel actually works well, too. But if it's got all the fines in it, it'll pack tight and it'll get full of weeds. Just like if you ever had a gravel driveway, Larry, it still gets weeds, especially on the edges or in a wet season. The wash gravel won't allow that to happen because it maintains the airspace in between and no moisture is able to be, you know, present for those plants to germinate and grow through. So
there you go, Don. Thank you very much for calling. Betty emailed and said, Findlay Hospital in Dubuque has Rose Bay Willow Herb in its landscaping. And she wants to know, where the heck can I get this plant? And when would I plant it? And she thinks it is the fireweed, in the fireweed family, but not like the wildfire weed. It has purple small flowers on the stem.
Well, I know that the true fireweed is not a native plant. Probably not. I've always thought of it as sort of an invasive species. Probably not one that I would ever plant in the garden. But I am not exactly sure of the species that we're talking about. And I'm looking on Google right now, and I'm not finding any information on that. Epilobium. Or the angustifolia, the regular fireweed. I don't know.
You might have to go back to Findlay Hospital in Dubuque. Actually, they wouldn't know, but they will know who does their landscaping.
Righto, righto.
And I would get the landscapers for the Findlay Hospital in Dubuque, and you'd probably do all this online in a matter of a few minutes and find it. Bill and Phelps, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Hey, I have a yard that my dog's favorite game is I throw the ball. It's on a gradual slope down the hill. She runs off the pier, jumps, and runs back. And in the process, the soil's very sandy up there, and she's tearing up all the grass as she comes running down the hill. And I haven't done the research yet, but I'm thinking maybe if the grass, I've tried it a few times, and it just isn't holding up. Is there something I can mix in with that? Like, will something that'll set a deeper root, like a clover or something that you're familiar with?
That's a good question. You know, a lot of people are encouraging these type of more environmental lawns. So it's, white clover. At Olbrich, we don't worry too much about weeds in our grass. We have plenty of clover in there, and it does form a nice mat right amongst the grass. Both are happy as a clam. That'd be worth a shot. Tell me again, where in the state are you?
I'm in Phelps. Pretty sandy soil.
And you might contact your local extension agent and see what they might have in their book. I'm not as familiar with the lawns in that part of the state, but I bet you could come up with something that would help stabilize that a little more.
Yeah, give a call to your county extension office and ask to talk to the ag agent or the horticulture agent. There may be one or the other. Sometimes the ag agent does the hort work too.
Sure.
And they will probably have some. I'm sure they've heard this question probably a number of times and could help you out. And then you'll get something that'll work in your area if you go to your county.
Exactly.
Martha in Menominee, hi.
Hey, Larry and Jeff. Say, can we switch from horticulture to sociology for one quick second? I've got 2.5 acres here, but across the street from me, I have Joe and Jack Suburban, who are out doing battling lawn mowing all summer. And it's a battle of the suburban dads, you know, whose yard is shorter and looks better. I did no-mow May. My yard looks a lot better right now because their yards look brown. One of my neighbors, one of the two guys, his wife goes out and sets the sprinkler at noon, and it runs all day, the whole month of August. How do I approach, in a nice way, in a neighborly way, how do I approach these folks and make a nice suggestion that perhaps they might want to think about watering at night or...
Yeah, that's that.
Or not watering,
right? And that's where it all needs to start. I think, or a good. I mean, a lot of people are so in love with their lawns that they're going to do anything to keep them green and weed free. And those are the people we really need to sort of think outside the box a little bit. You know, I try to just by example, change things, talk to people. I don't know exactly what, I'm not a sociologist, I'm a horticulturist, but it's a great thing to talk about. Maybe, I don't know, Larry, we need to get a sociologist on board with us here and see how we can change viewpoints.
Well, I like the idea of showing by example. If your own lawn looks good and your own, it's a way to bring it up in a conversation for sure, Martha. Jeff Epping is our guest today. Jeff is Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. So, gardening questions, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Lucia emailed to ask if it's right to think of watering a tree at the drip line for optimal watering. She was told that the drip line is under the furthest branches and the length of the branch of the tree dictates where to water and not at the trunk of the tree.
Well, I think anywhere from the trunk out to the very edge of the canopy. I mean, roots will go beyond that as well, of course, but sure. I think the majority of the fine roots, which are important to taking up moisture, are within that zone. So now on a younger tree, a brand new young tree that you put in, watering next to the trunk is probably perfectly suitable because that's where all the roots are going to be because they haven't had time to get out farther. But if it's a larger tree, I think that's a great idea. And, you know, what we're doing oftentimes with, say, watering maybe an evergreen hedge, like we talked about, that might be stressed from all the drought, is rather than using the standard sprinkler, we're using soaker hoses. Mm-hmm. And these days they have sort of a more of a cloth type of soaker hose rather than those stiff rubber ones, which are such a pain.
That are sitting in my garage because I can't get them to work right.
Right. Try to uncoil them without them kinking and all that. But these new ones, they're not inexpensive, but they're not exorbitantly expensive either. And bring them in the winter and put them in your basement or whatever to keep them from freezing, and they'll last a number of years. But those work out well because they get that moisture right where it needs to be, soaks right through the mulch, and then the mulch helps keep it in, and you're not spraying water all over the place, which then is kind of, you know, a lot of it's lost to evaporation and such. So that's a good way to water when you have a chance.
And I want to mention again, because we've had some listeners calling in and saying, how do I get that list again? Jeff has put together quite an extensive list, American Native Plants, Why, What, and How is the title of it. It's like 9 pages of natives, trees, native shrubs, native vines, native grasses and sedges, native forbs. A bunch of native, 120 at least, forbs, more than that. and then some recommended readings as well. And he's made that list available to us. If you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and then you'll get to my program, and you'll get to today's program. And in the program notes, you'll get the link there. So ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and go to today's program notes and it'll be listed right there for you. Let's go to Travis in Beaver Dam. Hi, Travis.
Hi. Early in the show, a caller had talked about buckthorn and getting rid of it by cutting it and then putting herbicide on it. I had seen some people use a black plastic bag to put over the cut stems to prevent light from coming in. I was wondering if you had any comments about that method.
I have, too, been aware of that method, and I don't know how successful it is, to be honest. I know I kind of heard about it when they were first doing it, and I don't know if I saw a YouTube video about it or something, but I just honestly don't know that that is doing the job. And I, when it's a very large, you know, stump, you know, several inches in caliper, I'll be honest with you, I just don't have enough experience to know. But again, I know the DNR also has information on how to rid woodlands and such of invasive species. So I'd probably look that up and see what their latest recommendation is.
Yeah, they may have comments. I can't remember if there are comments about black plastic bags over the buckthorn or not. I mean, there's issues with it because it tears and it, mm-hmm. there's problems. I know that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how effective they've been. And maybe somebody's listening who's seen some research or has mm-hmm. some experience with it. So stay listening, Travis. We'll see what we get.
Yeah, great.
Laura in New Richmond, we'll go to you. Hi, Laura.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I have a question about compost. I have a compost bin that I was, you know, advised just to put, you know, like vegetable peelings and things like that, no meat products or anything like that in the compost. Mm-hmm. But then I also, when I weed my garden, I get quite a pile of weeds, and I live in the city, so I don't know, should I have like, well, I kind of have two separate piles. I have my compost bin, but then I've been throwing all my weeds in a separate pile. What should I do about that? Or should I continue doing the same thing?
Yeah, well, so I, too, have a home compost pile. Everything goes into that. I'm usually quite fairly successful at getting my weeds pulled before they go to seed. And so I don't need to worry about the seeds in the compost. However, if you do have that, if you have some that have gone to seed, if your compost pile is managed properly, it gets to high enough temperatures where it'll kill those weed seeds. And so it won't be a big deal to put those in. So I would say you're probably okay, putting them all into one location.
One spot. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're okay, Laura. Thank you. Pat in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Pat.
Thanks. It's my first time calling your show. real basic question. My wife has got a hosta garden in the backyard around a blue spruce stump. All right. Well, Creeping Charlie has pretty much taken it over. Can I take my lawn clippings, pile that on to smother it, and then put wood chip mulch, you know, from the village over the top of that? Will that help choke that nasty thing out?
So are you saying it's so thick that it's actually like choked out the hostas, or is it just growing beneath the hostas?
It's growing beneath the hostas. So what I want to do is put the grass clippings down like a 4-inch mat of organic matter, and then put the wood chip over the top of that.
Yeah, that's getting pretty thick. I don't think any moisture is going to be able to penetrate any of that. Probably the best, you know, I don't know if you can just leave it ride for this season and come next spring, you know, just rake out all of that Creeping Charlie. It usually comes up pretty easily with a rake. Get it out of there, then put down your mulch of maybe 4 inches or so, and the hostas will come right up through that, or do that just as they're coming up so you can kind of work around them and, you know, kind of take it from there. Typically, you know, Creeping Charlie will grow in between that hosta, and they're not really hurting the hosta at all. So you know, it's just another ground cover underneath there. But if it really bothers you, I personally would wait till spring to deal with it. And probably better luck and a heck of a lot easier to do it then than it is now.
Pat, thank you. Appreciate it. Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a very beautiful shrub or bush of some kind that keeps coming back, and I do not want it. They can grow as high as 12 feet. So I'm going to hire someone to cut these right down to the ground. The stem is only about 2 inches at the most wide at this point. And then I thought, after this man is done using his saw, I'm going to go down there with a sharp-pointed instrument, like a screwdriver perhaps, stab down into that stump and pour toilet bowl cleaner down in there as a way of permanently getting rid of the roots. The reason I'm saying toilet bowl cleaner is because a lot of these brands of toilet bowl cleaners actually don't clean the toilet. So I've got it all sitting around here. I might as well use it. And it certainly must be a caustic material. Wouldn't that do away with the roots?
I would hesitate from using something like that. You know, that isn't really labeled for that use. I don't know what kind of environmental impact that would have. I mean, the herbicides that are available to treat that are you know, proven to work. And if you follow the directions, you know, you're doing, you know, doing it by the book, which is probably what I would recommend. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Know. In fact, we can't you know, I couldn't recommend something that wasn't labeled at least for it. And there could be some chemicals that are long lasting and live a long time, whereas many of the herbicides do not.
Right. They're designed to sort of photo decompose, or the microbes in the soil break them down. When we start putting all other chemicals that really aren't, you know, used for that purpose, I'd worry about that.
Yeah, there we go, Nancy. Thank you. Kathy in Reedsburg, your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I have a question about homemade compost. I was looking online, and it had beer, ammonia, pop, and water. Have you used it? Is it a good idea?
Oh, for an accelerator?
Yes.
So beer, ammonia.
Why would I want to put good beer on my compost pile when I could just drink it?
Oh, man.
Have yeast in it or something. That's part of that idea. And what was the other two? But that's not something I know about, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one either. Beer and ammonia.
Ammonia probably has nitrogen in it. It's probably a lot of the same things that, you know, like a fertilizer. Sometimes people put like a fertilizer, if you had excess lawn fertilizer, they might put that in their compost pile to a little degree to help speed up the decomposition or something like that. And it usually those, when you have these concoctions, they're really just variants of something else. And personally, my compost pile, I like to keep it a little more clean and pure, and it's going back into my garden. So I just let Mother Nature do the work for me, and I don't worry about.
So what does yours look like? Have you got, is it just a pile sitting there, or have you got it in a container? Is it?
Well, mine is I've made a wooden bin for it, a two bin system, so I can kind of toss it back and forth. But I don't know about our caller.
Oh, no, I meant you.
Oh, me. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I am not like a super composter, but the compost pile I have is the bins. I don't know. It's sort of probably 4x4x4, you know, two of those. And every bit of kitchen scrap goes in there, as well as the stuff in my garden. So it's I just have a standard city lot, you know, 60 sure. by 120 or whatever. It's works out well.
All right, there we go. Thank you very much, Kathy, for calling. Rita in Wisconsin Rapids emailed to ask if she can transplant native plants that are probably 5 to 10 years old. They're pretty well established, but she wants to move them to a different place in the yard.
Yeah, I mean, typically that's doable. It kind of depends on the species, maybe. I mean, like moving something like a Baptisia, even with a really deep root system or something like that. But we've still had success with that. I would recommend doing that in the spring, probably when the plants are dormant and you can get down there and really, you know, get as much root as possible and then divide them up and move them around. Larry mentioned that list of plants that I put together, and that was for a lecture I did for Olbrich's lecture series this year. I also did it for the Hardy Plant Society here in Madison. And I wanted, you know, at Olbrich, it's not like we are a completely native garden. And so I want to just make sure that everybody knows that. But what we're shooting for, and this is based on some of the recommendations by experts like Doug Talamy, who I'm sure many of you know, we're shooting for about 70% natives in our gardens. And I think that other 20-30% is of non-natives is certainly acceptable as long as you use plants that aren't invasive, so they're not getting out into our wild spaces. But I like to use those other plants to make the garden look beautiful at all times of the year. Mm-hmm. Because first and foremost, we want people to garden. We want more gardens. We want more flowers of all sorts. We want to get rid of some of that lawn, and expanding those gardens is important. And people, you know, garden for many different reasons, but I think everybody loves beauty. And so the use of some non-natives in our gardens is completely acceptable. And so, yeah, I know in my garden, I'm still not to 70% at home, and we're not at Olbrich either, but we're shooting for that goal. And every year we add more natives. If we remove, as we remove some things that are non, put in natives. And, you know, the native plants, they get a bad rap like they're weeds or something. They're beautiful. Yeah. I mean, look at you know, coneflowers, and so many of our native plants are as beautiful as any plant on the planet. In fact, they're super popular over in Europe. I mean, they're using them in all the meadows that they're creating over there. So it's always that thing is that you always want something that you don't have, and that's okay to a certain degree. But we're just trying to add those natives to help with the ecosystem, you know, services, if you will.
You know, in your list, you do mention Doug and his keystone plant. Yes. Idea. It's worth mentioning and talking a bit about that.
Yeah, so Doug has identified certain plants that really deliver the most bang for their buck. They support more insects and pollinators than other plants. And oaks in the tree world is that plant. They're the king and queen of the bunch, because they support so many different caterpillars that you and I typically don't even see. They're up in the canopy of the tree. They're living their lives, and they're providing an amazing amount of food for our songbirds. And the tree, and these are native cat. Now, we're not talking about, you know, the spongy moth or what we used to call the gypsy moth. We're not talking about invasive caterpillars, right? Those are horrible, and those shouldn't be here, but they are, and we're dealing with them. But there are so many insects that are native and grow with our native plants and support our native species of birds and all those things. And they all have co-evolved, so they all live happily together. And so they're very important. So the keystone plants are those that really are the key supporters of all those insects. And those are the ones that we really want to concentrate on, oaks being that biggest group.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have a caller, Dan in Spooner. I want to give him a chance to join in. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello. A couple years ago, we had a vacation in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and the forest floor was covered with beautiful blue violet flowers. And we found out later they were woodland phlox, or blue moon phlox, I guess. And I've had mixed success growing them. I did some in kind of sandy soil, didn't work so well. But what's the secret to growing woodland phlox? And can you talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, I grow phlox divaricata, which is one of our woodland phlox, in my garden at home. And, you know, it's in at least half shade. It's not in full sun by any stretch. And we have it at Olbrich. We noticed when we first planted it, we struggled because the rabbits liked it as much as we did. And so they were kept trimming it off as it was trying to get a foothold. So we caged them for the first couple seasons. Then once they were deeply rooted and growing well, we took those off. And what little the rabbits, you know, munch on them now is not a big deal because they're big, established, growing plants. And I found the same thing at home. So maybe, you know, you need to protect them a little bit in the first couple seasons. Just it's pretty simple to do and see how you do that way. And then, of course, any newly planted plant, whether it be a perennial or a shrub or a tree, they need a little extra TLC that first couple years. You know, again, even in the second season with a perennial, it might need a little extra water when we have an extended drought. And if you can get them past those things, you know, those first couple seasons, get their roots established, then they take on those drought tolerant qualities that we're looking for. But any newly planted plant, whether drought tolerant or not, is going to need a little extra help until it gets that root system established so it can be the drought tolerant plant for the future. So just a little bit about that.
And I've got some questions about that garden tour again. Once you want to repeat what the...
Yeah, so if you hit our website, olbrich.org, olbrich.org, look up 2022 Home Garden Tour. It's next Friday and Saturday, July 8th and 9th, from 9 to 3 p.m., and the gardens are all in Oregon, just south of Madison. It's about a 20 minutes or so drive. They're all clustered around each other, so many of them you can just park and walk to. And it's, yeah, a lot of fun. I think you'll really enjoy it.
And I'm looking at your events list, and I see the Blooming Butterflies exhibit is coming back again in a couple weeks.
Yes, finally, after the pandemic is... well, I don't know, over, but in a better place. We're finally bringing back Blooming Butterflies. So July 14th to August 7th, 10 to 4 daily. It's a great event.
Oh, I love that event.
Yeah, yeah. So it's in the butterflies are in our conservatory, but we also have outdoor activities through the garden that families can enjoy. So I encourage you to come out and see us. It's fun to have so many people back in the garden again, Larry. It's, we missed it.
It is indeed. And some people will not have seen the new building and so forth, which is fantastic. And
yeah,
so,
yeah. Lots to see.
I love getting up on top of the building and looking down at the gardens too. That's kind of a...
Yeah, we have a new rooftop garden as part of it. So
I like that.
Yeah, I agree.
Jeff Epping, our guest today. Jeff is Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Again, just go to our WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date and you'll find a link to the American Native Plants list that he has put together. It's a dandy, I tell you that for sure. Great to have him with us. Monday at 11, we'll talk about the relationship between monarch butterflies and milkweed. And then at 11:45, we'll look at wildflower hikes that you can take in Wisconsin. How about that? That's Monday on the Ideas Network. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.